Wow. Well, here we are. We had a whole conversation before we even turned the microphones on. Hey, everybody, I'm Colin Risdahl. I know. It was amazing.
And I'm Molly Wood. I know you're shocked to join our show already in progress. Welcome back to Make Me Smart, where together we try to make sense of the day. We're always podcasting friends. It's just that sometimes there's music. It is Tuesday, the day when we do our deep dive into a single topic.
The topic du jour is the state of American retirement, because as you will soon discover, some of us in this conversation have to think about it more than others. But look, the pandemic is real. The changes in this economy are real. And what is happening out there is very, very real. And look, we're living longer and we got to plan for that. And that's why we're having this conversation.
Yeah, exactly. A recent, and of course, COVID is complicating everything. A recent Wells Fargo survey found that almost 60% of workers impacted by the pandemic now say that they don't know if they have saved enough to retire because of COVID-19. Maybe they've had to make withdrawals. Maybe they were laid off. But it brings us to this kind of central question. Only about half of workers participate in a retirement plan at work. This is partly because employers are not required to offer 401ks or other retirement plans. And then on top of that, there's this kind of question about whether 401ks are the best way to save for retirement at all, whether they're actually helping people save and where they came from.
So we got Teresa Ghilarducci on the phone. She's a labor economist, also the director of the Schwartz Center for Economic Policy Analysis at the New School. Her book on the topic at hand is called Rescuing Retirement. Teresa, thanks for coming on.
Oh, I'm really glad to talk about this issue.
Well, let's establish a little ground truth here. Just as the expert in the room on this subject, how, generally speaking, how are we doing, Americans, and getting ready for retirement?
Yeah, I thought that Wells Fargo survey actually was optimistic, because if you sit down with Americans now and show them how much they need and how much they have, we would get 90% of people realizing they don't have enough. And that's because we didn't increase Social Security for the past 40 years, and we relied on this other kind of system. It was more of a hope rather than a plan that people would be able to save in a IRA or a 401k. But right now, 90% of people don't have enough to retire on.
Okay. So dark place right off the bat. Let's talk about these vehicles then, because it seems like that might be compounding the problem, right? Like the 401k might not actually be that efficient after all in terms of saving.
Yeah, I mean, I could just tell you a little bit about the good news, all right? So there's like 10% of the people that are prepared. And I have to tell you a story about how they got prepared in order to figure out where we go from here and how we actually bring those success, those institutions, you know, to everybody. So high income people are more prepared than low income people. But even high income people, a vast majority are not prepared. People making about $200,000 per year on average, they only have $200,000 in their retirement accounts. And that with Social Security will only be able to maintain their living standards for a year or two. You know, people at the very top have enough to replace their income, you know, when they retire. And actually, but people in the middle class and even lower income people, for those who have enough, it's because they've been in a defined benefit plan, either because they've worked for a unionized industry or they've worked for an employer who's afraid of a union and they put in a good pension plan to stave off the union, or they're in public employment. So there are a few Americans at all income levels that have a success story, that they're going to be able to live comfortably at their lifestyle all the way, you know, to the end of their lives. But most people won't. Most people at all income levels won't. And that's because we have built a system for the past 40 years that was supposed to work one way and it worked the other way.
Well, so let's actually back up for a minute. You've now a couple of times used the phrase for the past 40 years. So what happened 40 years ago that set us on the path to where we are today?
Yeah, so 40 years, we saw the hatchling 401k, you know, come on the scene. So the 401k is a part of the tax code that was put in 78, 79 that said that employers can deduct money from their workers' paycheck and put it into a retirement account, and it can it can accumulate tax-free. So it was a way for people to save for retirement at work. It was meant for highly paid management employees that didn't have a defined benefit plan, but anybody could be in it. And it was meant to kind of supplement, you know, a base pension. It was also up to the employer whether or not they contributed anything to the 401k. So it was voluntary on the part of the employee and voluntary on part of the employer. The employer just provided the platform for it. Well, as things went forward in 1981, it got to be marketed as a pension plan for all workers, but mainly as a supplement. At the same time in 1981, we had the air traffic controller strike. Ronald Reagan was president, and you had a real decline in labor power, in union power. So as 401ks were coming into ascendancy, you had labor power really falling. So over time, in about 7 years, the 401k for the employers that had a pension at all became the primary vehicle. Now, if it were supposed to be the primary vehicle for American savings, it would have been called the primary vehicle for American savings or the Great American Retirement Plan. It wouldn't have been called, an obscure section of the IRS code. So right off the bat, the name and the hope for it, you know, there was a big mismatch.
And then you said on Marketplace, actually, about 10 years ago-ish, that 401ks are a failed experiment. Yeah. Here we are still. What are the major problems that you see? And do people know this?
You know, and actually 10 years ago, as it was a failed experiment, because I could look forward and now I have the benefit of seeing if my forecasts were correct. And they're actually a little bit worse because we've now had two recessions, and the last recession caused interest rates to probably permanently fall. You know, so if anybody wants a portion of their pension plan to be in a safe asset, they're going to get much lower returns than they got in the 1980s. So even the spreadsheet models, you know, won't work that well. It would have worked if people had contributed 10% of their pay, starting at 25, kept that money in a professionally managed low fee account for 40 years. Never had a break of service, never had a divorce, never had a period of unemployment, never got suckered in by, you know, a high fee manager or financial advisor. So a robot with a spreadsheet, you know, could have made the system work. But the problem is that the system wasn't built for the human beings that we have, or the labor market that we have. So we really have lucky people, and there are a few of them, who had jobs and lives like that, and always had a low fee commercial option in their 401k. But most employers don't know how to pick vehicles for their portfolio, and now employers are being sued all over the place for having 200, 300 options in the retirement account, where most of them are some kind of stocks and the fees are 1%. They're really under-regulated. So I just listed all the ways that it's a failed experiment. They're individually directed. The person has to decide how much to put in. They're voluntary. The person voluntarily contributes and the employer voluntarily contributes. The individual has to decide what the portfolio looks like, and hardly any individuals are prepared for that. It's like we were all asked for the past 40 years to do our own dentistry, and there was like no plan for how people would. So let's say it all worked out, and you came to retirement with $1 million, which is what sort of a middle-class person needs to supplement their Social Security. Because, you know, meanwhile, the last 40 years, we've let Social Security kind of languish. Let's say you had $1 million and you were pushed out by COVID, at 62. What in the world are you going to do with $1 million? Let's say you have $500,000, by the time you reach 75 and you're going into your cognitive decline years, and you are asked to actually do the most complex financial management most people on this earth will ever have to do right when you're less able to do it. And it makes Americans completely prey for financial predation. We have much higher levels of financial predation on the elderly than any other country. So I, you know, did I, the well, failure is in its design.
So this conversation keeps getting better and better. It started
exactly.
with me being close to retirement before we turned the microphones on. And now it's me being in cognitive decline, trying to make financial calculations.
This is a tough day for Kai.
It's simply terrifying. But look, it makes you understand why people don't want to think about this, because it's daunting. And the idea that a middle-class person has to have $1 million in the bank when they retire is that's like from another planet, you know? Mm-hmm.
And that they'll lose 20% of that to fees over the years.
To fees. Mm-hmm. They'll lose 20 to 30% of that with fees. And also we've actually produced something even darker, is that we've produced a nation of older people who are isolated, pushed out of their jobs before they thought they would, having to collect Social Security earlier than they thought they would, and also an inadequate accounts, all sorts of regrets, and a big dose of shame. And so that's what happens in your do-it-yourself system, is that you tell people, hey, you can do it yourself, and you give them the tools, and it looks like, you know, something when I try to repair my dishwasher. You know, it's a huge mess. Or if we had to do our own electricity or our own dentistry. It's a system that was designed to fail, but also make people feel pretty ashamed by the time they get to retirement.
I mean, it just, that's a little meta about our country sometimes. But on top of that, I'm going to go to one last issue before we hopefully get to solutions. On top of all of that, what people can actually invest in their 401ks is also limited. Like here they have fees and it's really complicated. But on top of that, the employers choose all of the options so that most employees who are saving for retirement are locked out of things like Amazon, right? Or Apple or Tesla.
Oh, Molly, that's actually much more relevant. Some of the best funds in Vanguard, you know, or low fee funds, you know, at basically Vanguard or Fidelity. I mean, that's here. Want to have a built-in conflict of interest? You have an employer that meets with the brokers and picks the vehicles that you have to invest in. And then the broker says, hey, we've got it made here. I'll pass on all the fees to your employees. They won't see what the fees are. And then you and me can have a deal here. I'll charge them unscrutinized fees. You don't have to pay anything. And you can tell your employees, we'll give you marketing information, that you're providing them with a plan. And again, that plan is something like, if you do the right thing and you're the right person and you save enough, you'll be okay. The implications are, you know, if you don't do the right thing, you won't be. So the employer picks the vehicles, but they have no stake in how much those vehicles cost, and they have no stake in the outcome. That was not the what happened with a defined benefit plan. The employer promised a certain amount of money at the end of their people's work lives. So they carefully chose who the professional managers were, and they carefully chose what the fees were. So the employer set it up, they get all the credit, and they have no accountability.
So look.
Great.
So a 401k is a failed experiment, and we're all going to not have enough money. What are we supposed to do now? Because, look, you were on Marketplace 8 or 10 years ago saying this stuff, and people have been saying it for, you know, a decade or more now. It's not like we didn't know this is a problem. What are we supposed to do?
Yeah, no. So, you know, there really is a lot of hope. The Democrats came in with a very detailed platform for retirement security. And Biden himself has been involved in this issue for quite a long time. And the other big hope, maybe this is really a hope for nerds, but it really is hope for policy, is that we almost all agree on the numbers. You know, there isn't anybody on the left wing, right wing, up wing, down wing, you know, that that can argue that people are prepared for retirement. So we're at a point that we know we have a crisis, and it's affecting, well, in the next 10 years, another 30 million people. And all those 30 million people, older people who are in the workforce, they vote. The time is ripe, you know, for big policy changes. So what are they? One of them is to recognize that healthcare expenses can really waylay the best laid plans, you know, for retirement. So Biden has suggested that Medicare age be reduced to age 50. To 60. I propose 50, but he proposes 60. And that means that people that were pushed out of their jobs, could actually not have to draw down on their retirement accounts just to pay for healthcare. So that's one thing. The bigger thing is that we seem to be in a place where we're going to expand Social Security and not cut benefits, and doing that by raising revenues from people who can most afford it, people who make over $250,000 or $400,000, depending upon the proposal. And as I said, all the kind of experts agree on the numbers, so we won't have that barrier will be over. The other thing that we can do, and I think we can see this in the next year. Pete Buttigieg had a very complete plan, and Biden has something that isn't as complete. But it's the idea that 50% of Americans don't have anything at all to look forward to for retirement except Social Security. They don't have a 401k. Remember, I pointed out that it's voluntary on the employer. Mm-hmm. And the idea was that we would have a pension plan, a highly regulated 401k type plan for everyone. One proposal is the federal employees have something called the Thrift Savings Plan, and they have about four or five options. These are all low fee options. They're highly curated. Why not just open up that plan for all workers to contribute to? Also, employers mm-hmm. could contribute to that. There are a lot of states, about 15 states, where employers are required to provide an option, you know, for workers to save for their individual retirement plan at work. But the much more hopeful option is a pension plan for all Americans, where employers, workers, and the government through tax subsidies and tax breaks would contribute to a worker's retirement plan. And then if people need to have a sidecar emergency plan, we have to actually make sure that they can save for emergencies at work. But we have to break the connection between retirement savings and putting your kid through mm-hmm. school savings or your divorce, you know, settlement savings or all the other things that come up that you need money for instantly. So just to sum up, the hope is that we expand Social Security, make healthcare available for more older Americans, and provide a pension plan for all Americans.
Teresa Ghilarducci, labor economist and director of the Schwartz Center for Economic Policy Analysis at the New School. Teresa, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks, really good Teresa. To talk to you. And good to talk to you again, Kai.
Nice to talk to you.
Take good care.
Depressing as it was.
Bye-bye.
No, it's hopeful. Come on. It ended great. We got okay. this. We can do it.
Okay. Fine.
I mean, at least we are talking about it at the right time, I will say. Yeah. It is clearly a thing that needs to get fixed.
Yeah.
People may be in the mood to fix some stuff.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. The right vibe now. Is fixing stuff. That's totally true. That's totally true.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that was fascinating. I learned a lot. That was just as much. 401ks, turns out, are just as much a disaster as I had heard.
So if you've got thoughts, comments, questions, send them along about today's conversation or anything else you hear on this podcast. You can reach us at makemesmart@marketplace.org as we do on the Tuesday pod. A quick break, and then we're coming back.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.
Get one of the most successful broadcasts in television history on your schedule with the 60 Minutes podcast. Hard-hitting investigative reports, news, and culture maker interviews and in-depth profiles are waiting for you in every episode. Listen to 60 Minutes every Sunday wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, welcome back. How y'all feeling about the rest of your life? Good, good. It's going to be fine. It's going to be fine.
It's all going to be fine. Teresa Gillard, she told me it was all going to be fine.
She said eventually it was totally all going to be fine, even though right now it's like a really bad disaster. Oof. Woo, that was fun. Okay. Yeah. Shall we do the news fix?
Let's. Okay, so here's mine, and apparently I stole it from Ms. Wood, who, to be clear, put it in the Marketplace Slack at 7:30 this morning, and I did not see it before I snagged it. But the NASDAQ, which is one of the big stock exchanges, as hopefully listeners to Marketplace know, has gone to the Securities and Exchange Commission, its chief regulator, and said, hey, we want a new rule that makes the companies that list on the NASDAQ to regularly report on their board of directors' diversity and also, and this is really the key part here, that those companies have at least one woman director and a member of a minority on the board. That's and, not or, by the way.
Yeah,
which is key. And this is huge. It's overdue. I do find it so interesting, and I get that finances and the financial sector is heavily regulated, among the most heavily regulated in this economy. I think it's interesting that they had to ask the SEC for permission to do this when it seems so commonsensical. But it is absolutely a step in the right direction, and this RT is an endorsement. That's all I've got to say.
Yeah. I thought this was actually really pretty remarkable.
Yeah.
Especially because, as we know, boards— you know, I think like there's a lot of conversation about what happens in companies with bosses and managers and whatever, boards. And then when it comes to like venture capital, the investors, the limited partners, the people who control the money and are in charge of firing people, that's where you really have to make change. And so I thought it was a good rung on the ladder for the NASDAQ to tackle.
Yeah. And just to pick up on the rung on the ladder thing, like, so some companies have already done this, right? Like Goldman has made a condition of, you know, being taken public that you have diversity on your boards of directors. But this has the potential to be systemic, right? Because there are thousands of companies that list on the NASDAQ. And so that's why this is a big improvement. Anyway.
Yeah. It's a big deal. Yeah. I agree.
Yep.
It is World AIDS Day. Mm. And there have been all these interesting stories about kind of like how, because of COVID, and in fact, as Fortune put it, talking about AIDS in the middle of the still unchecked coronavirus pandemic may seem out of tune. But what is happening is that a lot of programs, HIV programs, are facing disruptions or budget cuts. That HIV and AIDS, although it is, you know, essentially, it is a treatable condition. It's now a chronic condition for a lot of people, and the medication has become really inexpensive. A lot of people don't get that treatment, and of course, it's uneven, much like COVID-19. In fact, in America, Black Americans account for 43% of new HIV infections. And so you have this sort of like double pandemic ongoing. I, like, full disclosure, grew up, my mom did a lot of HIV/AIDS education in the 80s. I did a lot of like youth focused like education on reservations, specifically around HIV and AIDS. And so I made a tweet thread about this the other day, and I'm surprised it took me so long to really internalize it. But HIV and AIDS in America is basically the last time that America treated a pandemic the way we have treated coronavirus. Like, it was a pandemic that was downplayed, ignored, and led to, you know, over the course of the Reagan presidency, those 8 years, 90,000 deaths, many of which were probably preventable. And it's now killed something like 30 million people worldwide. And you just kind of wonder, like, what would have happened if we'd gotten in that game immediately?
Yep.
Like, it took 4 years between HIV appearing in the United States, really starting to kill people, specifically in San Francisco, and Reagan saying the word.
Yeah.
AIDS. Yeah. 4 years.
Yep.
And we moralized it, and we, you know, and it's just like, it's hard to watch us repeating that pattern not that many years later within my actual lifetime. And it hits all the more home because when I was doing that work, I lived in North Dakota, which hit a new COVID milestone today. 1 out of 800 residents is now dead from COVID-19.
Hmm. Yeah, we keep making the same mistakes. We keep making the same mistakes.
We really, really, really do.
All right.
It's hard. It's hard to watch. Anyway, sorry, I brought us way down.
That's all
way
right.
down.
That's right. We're going to let our listeners bring us back up. Let's hit the mailbag.
Hello, Molly and Kai.
It's Brianna from Phoenix.
Ivan from Brooklyn, New York.
Longtime listener, first-time voicemailer.
I want to discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
I've got a new favorite in that. I think I like the beginning guy. Hello, Molly and Kai. I like that guy.
I love that guy.
I like that guy. I like that guy.
He's so jocular.
Yeah.
Hello. I know. Love it. Love it. All right. We heard from a lot of you over the Thanksgiving break. Thank you for still thinking of us. And here's our first voice memo.
Hey, this is Bria and Tony calling from Kansas. And we just wanted to thank you guys for bringing us to our senses a little bit. We got in the car last Saturday morning with the intent of driving to Vermont to spend our Thanksgiving with family. And we had all the excuses, right? Oh, there's only 7 of us and we're going to be in a house in the woods the whole time. And most of us got tested and all that. And we were about 2 hours into our drive when we decided to catch up on episodes of Make Me Smart and put on all the good episodes from last week. And got through about 2 of them before we got to Please Stay Home for Thanksgiving. And it just kind of shook us out of our, you know, little bubble of BS that we've been living in and the stuff that we've been telling ourselves. And we turned around and we're going to have a nice Thanksgiving here at home with just the 2 of us. So thank you all and have just a wonderful, wonderful, small, lovely Thanksgiving.
Well. That was great. That was great. I mean, I feel sad for her because you can hear the sadness in her voice, right? And I apologize for that. But look, it's what it takes. I will tell you, a very good friend of our family came down with COVID over the Thanksgiving break. So look, this stuff happens. Even if he was being safe, his family was being safe, all this stuff. So it's real and it happens. And thank you for staying home. I'm sorry you got 2 hours into the drive though. That's kind of a bummer because that turns into a 4-hour drive.
It's just heartbreaking.
Yeah.
I'm both like thrilled and also saddened that Make Me Smart is like the trusted advisor in the room. Like there's so many failures that lead to our podcast being the thing that gets through.
That's right.
But like,
I'm sorry,
you know what?
Us for advice? Yeah.
I'm still glad to hear it. Yeah. I hope you had a great one.
Yeah. 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 Okay. Haley in Florida. Hit it.
Hi, Kai and Molly. I'm a current graduate student, and something I think is being left out of the don't travel for Thanksgiving conversation is the role that college students are going to play. Most universities are going online after Thanksgiving, so a lot of college students are left with basically no choice but to travel home from wherever they're attending college. Speaking as someone who will be teaching freshmen in person in the spring, I also think it's disturbing how few colleges have adjusted their spring reopening plans given the way COVID numbers are trending right now. And a lot of universities are still planning to come back next semester with the majority of students in person. Thanks for listening, and I love the show. Keep up the great work.
Haley, I'm going to do something I don't often do, but I'm going to ask for a follow-up voice memo on how you feel about teaching freshmen in the spring. Because first of all, your overall point is completely correct about college students being the diaspora and taking all this stuff back at Thanksgiving. And wow. But honestly, how are you feeling about being in the classroom? Because that, look, that would just be scary for me.
Yeah. The university situation is a thing that America is going to have to answer for. I mean, like what's Scott Galloway predicted. Everyone I know about three people who have college-age kids. I mean, I probably know more than that. But of the three people who I know have college-age kids and I talk to about Thanksgiving, every single one of them had the plans for their kid to come home canceled at the last minute because a roommate got COVID.
Every one of them. Wow.
Like just bananas. So many college kids either did come home because nobody got tested or didn't because someone did. And it's a disaster. Yeah. And the plowing ahead with the plans that you made 6 months ago before we were back at the gigantic surge we're in now thing is, oh yes, I believe repeating the same mistakes all over again. Okay. One last voice memo. Thank you for all the voice memos. Yay! From Catherine in Michigan.
Hi, Kai and Molly. It's a little bit after 10 p.m. on November 26th, and I'm sitting in the parking lot about to go into work for Black Friday. I'm not in retail. I'm actually in shipping. So next week is Cyber Week when we are in full holiday peak mode. This peak is definitely going to be interesting with COVID and a lot of people or a lot more people ordering online. We've been hiring for this peak since about August, and our operation is one of the larger ones in the region, and we're still on our inside operations about 80 people short of our target. We're really not sure how this season's going to go. We'll get through it, of course, we always do, but it's probably going to be a rough one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
On so many levels.
Yep. And that whole you know, thing who aren't customer-facing in retail but have to support retail, like shipping people, those are all real essential jobs that, you know, stuff shows up on your doorstep from Amazon and you're like, hey, here it is. Guess what? People made this happen.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, and just, you know, this is like the perfect example of consumers make up 80% of gross domestic product in the United States. Like if there is one operation that we cannot slow in any way in this country, it's shopping.
Americans buy.
Please keep shopping. And all of it's now, you know, going online, not as much as it should. People were still apparently lined up for things on Black Friday.
Yeah.
But it's a whole ecosystem. We will now leave you with an answer to the Make Me Smart question, which is I elided the word toxic ecosystem because it does also employ a lot of people, but sometimes it just feels a little messy.
Yeah.
We will now leave you with an answer to the Make Me Smart question, which is what is something you thought you knew, but you later found out you were wrong about?
Donnell Baird provided today's answer. He's the CEO and the founder of a startup called Block Power.
I just didn't understand the like beauty and stress, but awesomeness of being a parent. It is just really a gift to be a parent. Being a parent is so much harder than being a CEO. It's like not even close. My son is like the best negotiator. Like he is the best negotiator I've faced in the last 12 months. No question. I also didn't realize how difficult it is for working parents in America to really, you know, work and be parents at the same time. I think, you know, that's exacerbated by this pandemic. But I think generally, like how tough it is to be a working parent, you know, that's something that's going to have to be dealt with.
Yeah, for sure.
I love how he says dealt with. Like, I like this idea that, you know, we talk about millennials as this huge generation. I don't know how old Donnell is, but I keep thinking, like, I bet a lot of millennials are going to start having babies. And when you have a generation the size of the boomers, all with, like, little kids at home being like, whoa, this is some BS how you have to live.
Yeah.
Then maybe the vibe will indeed be fixing things. Yeah. Donnell Baird, by the way, will be featured in our upcoming Marketplace Tech special called How We Survive Adapting to Climate Change. It's starting later this week. You can hear it on some select public media stations. The Block Power story is super interesting. not only what they do, but how they're turning it into a financial instrument, which is like how change really happens in this,
right.
in this country.
Luck, follow the money.
Super interesting.
Yeah, for sure.
Send us your answers to the Make Me Smart question. You know the drill. Email, voice memos, makemesmart@marketplace.org. Keep them coming.
Tomorrow is, of course, What Do You Want to Know Wednesday. We'll be back then. But before we go now, very quick PSA from our fundraising squad, eh?
Yes, it is Giving Tuesday. And starting now, and I like love this, the Candida Fund is matching donations 3-1. This is unprecedented. Biggest match ever.
So what you got to do is go to marketplace.org/givesmart. And if you give $50, it becomes $200. If you give $100, it becomes $400. It's really kind of amazing.
I feel like somehow we should have rolled this into the 401k. Like this is like how savings works, kind of.
That's right.
$250 becomes $1,000. And then you can retire in your cognitive decline years. Okay. For those of us who did tell us what they wanted to give in past drives but didn't want to make us drink a pumpkin spice beverage, now is your chance. Yeah. Marketplace.org/givesmart. Guilt-free. There are no stunts attached, but there are some good giveaways.
And look, the deal is that we know these are extraordinarily hard times for a lot of people. And a lot of people can't give, and that's fine. And if you can't, don't. But please keep listening. But if you can... we appreciate it. The only way Marketplace works, and not just this podcast, but Molly's show and my show and David's show and Rima's show and Chrissy Clark's show and all those other things that we do, the only way this works is if we have support from people who listen. Make Me Smart is just the pointy end of the sword, as it were. Marketplace.org/givesmart, and we appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Make Me Smart is produced and directed by Marissa Cabrera, who is crushing it. Yeah. Tony Wagner is our digital producer. Ethan Perez, you know, is crushing it. He's our intern. Erica Phillips writes our newsletter and our smart speaker skill.
Garrett Lang is on the other side of the studio glass for me engineering today. Emma Erdbrink is going to mix it later. The senior producer is Donna Tam. The executive director of On Demand is Sitar Nieves. And there we go.
Love our show. Yeah.
Works out pretty well.
We're so lucky.
Well. Garrett's just riding it, man. He's like, I'm going to listen to more of this music.
He's rocking.
Let's just push that slider up.
Let's do it.
Man.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.